Afternoon and welcome. Excuse me. Welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. This week, we're going to take a dive into the increased anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism on American college campuses and perhaps find a way to deal with it. The concern was elevated for us this week, in part from an odd nexus of a sports bar and anti-Semitism. Last week, some nasty young people at Barstool Sansom Street in Philly had that sign. You know that sign? The one that NECAP had at Coachella? They photographed it in the bar and posted it on social media, where it went viral. The immediate reaction of Barstool's owner, David Portnoy, who is Jewish, was equally unprintable. His second reaction was to have the perpetrators agree to go and visit Auschwitz concentration camp for an education at his expense. Now, after agreeing, the perpetrator has now reneged and says that he is a victim of something, something, I don't know what. But the question is the question, whether we're talking about Barstool Bar or Harvard Yard. What's going on? And is Holocaust education at Auschwitz the answer to anti-Semitism in America? Our guest today is Max Abrams of Northeastern University, a man well-placed to tackle that question. But before we go to Max, your JPC commercial. The Jewish Policy Center was established in 1985 as a nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policy. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Most important today, and most days since 10/7, we support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the efforts of the government of Israel and the IDF to defend the people of Israel on all of its borders and, when necessary, beyond those borders. And we support justice in Gaza. The JPC stands for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. You can find our insight articles and our magazine In Focus Quarterly. The spring issue is up. It's our domestic issue. It's a good one. I like it. You should go check it out. You can also binge watch our previous webinar programs. And now, our guest. Max Abrams is a tenured professor at Northeastern University. He is an expert in international security, especially in the areas of terrorism, U.S. foreign policy, great power competition, war, and the international relations of the Middle East. He's held fellowships and other research positions in an extraordinary number of colleges and universities, making him the ideal candidate for today's conversation. Stanford University, Dartmouth College, Johns Hopkins, George Washington, Tel Aviv University, and Harvard are among them. He's also worked with a number of institutions, including the Human Security Center in London, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, our neighbor, the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy, the Center for the Study of Terrorism in Rome, and the Council on Foreign Relations, another neighbor. Max appears regularly in all the media outlets that you would expect, and he consults with government agencies about the landscape of contemporary extremism. Max Abrams, welcome to the program. Tell us what we need to know.
Thanks so much. So I want to begin on 10/7, I guess, the flood. This was the second most lethal, or the most lethal killing of Jews since the Holocaust. We often talk about the amount of bloodshed that was perpetrated on that day. A point that isn't made nearly as much is the number of perpetrators. The number of perpetrators was also highly, highly unusual. I know of no terrorist attack which had so many perpetrators. So the estimates range, but I believe it was over 4,000 terrorist perpetrators. If you go into the Global Terrorism Database and you sort it out by perpetrators, there's no other attack with that number. And that really does matter because there's power in numbers. The more perpetrators, the more killing power. So it's just such a highly unusual attack, and the amount of suffering as well as the power of the perpetrators. And just 3 days later, on 10/10, I was preparing to teach my evening class on terrorism and counterterrorism. I was just hanging out by my office in the hallway, and some student pressed into my hand a flyer. He said, "Are you Max Abrams?" And I sort of nodded, and hands me this flyer, and it's to attend some pro-Palestinian resistance vigil, whatever you call it, not far from Northeastern University over at Cambridge. And I found that to be kind of chilling because, for one thing, you're not supposed to have student activists in that area by my office, but also just 3 days later, after Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, I'm being invited to attend a pro-Hamas event. I didn't do anything. I just took the flyer, tucked it away in my office, and soon after headed over to class. And when I got there, I recognized that one of the people in the room, seated among the students, was the very activist who had handed me the flyer. And so I went up to him and said, this class is just open to my students." And he said, "Well, he is a student at the university, just not one of my students." And he needed to make sure that my class reflected his views on Israel. And he had his computer open, and I'm sure that he was going to be, live tweeting about my performance. And I told him the class really couldn't start until he left the classroom. And you could imagine it wasn't really a smooth conversation. I knew that if I called, security or somebody to intervene, it was going to take, half an hour. So I wanted to just deal with this on my own so I could begin teaching. My class that day, interestingly, wasn't about Israel, wasn't about Gaza. It was actually about right-wing extremism in the United States. So he refused to leave. He made a huge scene. Everybody was watching him. This is cutting into class time. Class meets just once a week, so I kind of need to get going. And finally, he says he will leave my classroom, but conditional on giving a speech. And so he's all, aroused and animated and storms the classroom, just saying that higher education is biased, and Israel is bad, and inviting everybody in my class to walk out, to leave my classroom, and to go cross town to Cambridge for this pro-Hamas event. I didn't immediately file a complaint, but then he hounded me a bit. He was hanging out again by my office, told me to my face to fuck off, and was kind of a menacing guy. And on top of that, I wasn't the only Jewish faculty member that he targeted. Another Jewish faculty member of mine was also targeted by him. The activist wanted to ensure that there were no Israeli authors, even though my colleague's course was not about Israel. So this was two cases of certainly infringing on academic freedom. And with that, I filed a complaint, a formal complaint against the student, as did my colleague separately. And there was absolutely no dispute empirically as to what had happened. I had photos of him in my classroom taking it over. He emailed me, a menacing note, acknowledging what he had done. So there was absolutely no dispute as to what had happened, incontrovertible, including by the student, who is a student actually at Northeastern, but not one of my students. And so I file this complaint and I keep asking, I want to be updated on the status of my complaint against the student. And the body that does this wouldn't give me any information. And then several months later, my phone starts blowing up, and it's by friends and colleagues telling me that there's a huge incident at my university, Northeastern, where the graduation ceremony had been taken over by a pro-Intifada student. He had the iconic, blood on his hands, and he's on the stage shouting, anti-Israel slogans, and had to be dragged off in the middle of a graduation ceremony in front of, who knows, hundreds, thousands of Northeastern students and their families. And I look at the photos, and it's the exact same student who had taken over my classroom. So what this immediately told me is that the university clearly didn't do anything. Or maybe they did something, but it wasn't enough. There he was, getting his degree. And when I commute into work, I go in about twice a week. I have a habit of calling my mother and just, checking up on her. And she invariably asks me, how's Northeastern doing? Like, is it still like this crazy environment? And what she means is, are there any more sort of students who are actively interfering in my ability to teach? And I think that this is a common view by the public as to what the problems are for Jewish and the few Zionist faculty within higher education is to really focus on these student, whatever you want to call them, intifadas, interruptions, riots, protests. And it makes a lot of sense to focus on them. They are highly salient, deeply problematic. And they really capture a lot of the headlines. However, if I want to leave you with one point today, it's that my main problem as a Jewish Zionist faculty member has not actually been the students. I mean, yes, it was concerning to me, but I can't actually say that student or any of the students, truly negatively affected my life. The much bigger problem in higher education, it's not the student activists, it's actually the administrations. You want to understand these student intifadas without understanding that they are actually an extension of the administrations. It's not just like some random coincidence that so many of these, bad intifadas happen on campuses. They have actually been created by the universities at the absolute highest levels. I want to ask you a question to think about, which is, why is it that there is no Middle East Studies department in the United States at any kind of a normal major research university? which is not anti-Zionist. I do not know of a single Middle East studies department at like a normal, like major research university, which is not anti-Zionist. That is a very basic, but I think important corrective to some of this insane narrative that we hear from people like Glenn Greenwald, who's not a professor and doesn't live in America and doesn't know anything about higher education, because he likes to say the opposite all the time. He has this huge following, and he says there's no academic freedom on campus. It's all like pro-Israel. Well, I've asked him, if that were the case, then why don't you please list for me even just one university, major research university, that comports with that claim of yours? And of course, he was unable to name a single one. And I am also unable to say to name a single one. The reason why I say normal research university is because I'm not going to include Brandeis, which was created by Jews. Wouldn't include Yeshiva University. That's obvious. It obviously has its own thing going. But there is no major normal research university in America where the Middle East Studies Department is not anti-Zionist. And this is by design coming from the very top. We could conceptually answer this question in two ways. The first has to do with hiring, of course, the hiring of faculty. A Zionist job talk doesn't ever happen. If there is a whiff of Zionism, in somebody's job talk, it is absolutely terminal to them, as a candidate. They will not become a professor. And I have to say that even though I very much appreciate what Trump is doing within higher education, it's going to be really, really hard to change many of the practices which are so anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist. And that is because the faculty, the current faculty at universities, play a large role in who gets hired. And so over time, let's say it began with 60% of the faculty were strongly anti-Zionist. You can imagine if it's a majority wins that in all likelihood, the next hire would be anti-Zionist. And in all likelihood, based on the composition of the faculty, the next hire after that would be anti-Zionist. But over time, what has happened is the composition of faculty has become so anti-Zionist that even anything that has the whiff of a Zionist job talk wouldn't make it through. I could tell stories even about my conversations with search committees, with the faculty members who comprise search committees looking for, to hire a professor to deal with Israel. And they have told me explicitly that being anti-Zionist, that being deeply critical of Israel, is an absolute prerequisite for the position. Of course, we could also talk about the foreign money and how Qatar is the biggest funder in terms of foreign countries into American higher education. And frankly, Qatar is really smart about it because they make their gifts conditional on promoting their political values, whereas historically, American Jews haven't done this. They've given money to universities and they've assumed that that money is going to be used in a sensible way. So part of the reason why faculty are so overwhelmingly anti-Zionist, of course, has to do with hiring. But the other issue is that if there is like a case where in higher education, where a faculty member is Zionist and they also, teach about the Middle East and anti-Semitism in the way that I do, you're going to be punished. And life is going to be hard for you within higher education. And so some examples are that endowed professorships are not open to me. I'm told explicitly that you have to be a big critic of Israel to get the position. This is true, by the way, regardless of who funds the endowed professorship. I know of a case where the funders were actually strongly Zionist, but it still went to an anti-Zionist in defiance of the preferences of the family that gave the money. In my case, a lot of my service is for Jewish students at the university. I'm the, advisor, the faculty advisor for the Chabad House, the student group called Huskies for Israel. It's the only pro-Israel student group. I was on the board at Hillel, and in these annual merit reviews, faculty are to list their service. And my service to Jews typically didn't count, whereas it would count for any other minority group. When I write, publish research about Israel or, the conflict, I've been told that that's not. They don't really look at it so favorably. So I'm actually paid less and I'm less eligible for promotion, or ineligible, I should even say. And so I would say that these two factors, the anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism with respect to hiring, but also the mistreatment that faculty experience if they are, Zionist in any way, make it so that these universities coming from the very top are basically incubators for anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. I'll close in just one second, but just to really concretize this, I've even seen a case where one of the students at one of these, Antifada rallies at university said, "I don't understand why I'm getting in trouble. This is exactly what my professors have taught me." And in a way, I thought that that was a good point. And so when we do look at all of these student uprisings, please do understand that they are by design. They have been cultivated at the very highest levels. And in some cases, it's a bit of a Frankenstein situation where they create a problem. And in some cases, it can get out of control beyond the even the wildest expectations of the administration. But on the other hand, these student uprisings, they give the administration an opportunity to scold the students for seemingly being, anti-Semitic or anti-Zionist, and it almost elevates the university and it makes it seem as if it stands against this behavior. So in a way, these uprisings can be beneficial for the administration, even though ultimately they share the exact same political preferences.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here and say, Max, first of all, it is not what I really had expected you to say. This is a horrifying look at what is happening on college campuses. And it raises a question for me. I'm going to take the privilege of the first question myself. Is this, you lay this to the faculty and administration, is this really about Jews and Israel? Or is this more of what George Gilder explained as a conglomeration of leftist groups coming together as intersectionalists? And Israel becomes a convenient coalescing point. Are these people really, truly anti-Israel, or is this the most convenient way to express your leftist credentials? I'm trying to figure out why these people hate Israel so much.
Sure. Well, this is a tough question, which is the relationship between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. The answer is that in some cases, they can be separated. In many cases, they cannot be. I do believe that even before Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, there was a strong anti-Semitic impulse within higher education. I actually believe that DEI is inherently anti-Semitic. Now, some people say, some kind of ignorant people, usually on the left, they could say, how could you not support DEI? You don't support diversity and inclusion. But I personally make a distinction between DEI, which is the program in reality, versus what it stands for. I am certainly pro-diversity and certainly pro-inclusion. And by its own standard, DEI has been a colossal failure. Several years ago, before Operation Al-Aqsa Flood and the eruption of the Global Intifada, I tried to meet with the chief diversity officer at Northeastern to let him know about all of the discrimination that I was seeing and honestly experiencing. And I was told that actually anti-Semitism is outside the remit of DEI. And so from the very beginning, DEI has been more about power. It's been about empowering certain minorities at the expense of other minorities and at the expense of, frankly, of the majority as well in many cases, particularly for white men. And that entire interaction I thought was very illuminating. I work closely with the rabbi at Chabad in at Northeastern, and I told him this story. And you know what he said? That the chief diversity officer told him the exact same thing. And so that's really remarkable that basically the head of DEI would openly acknowledge that Jews were simply not protected by it. Over the past couple of years or so, we've had the huge terrorist attack and the Israeli response in Gaza. I do believe that international relations dynamic created cover for a lot of anti-Semites to come out of the woodworks in the name of Palestine. But the double standard is really obvious to anyone who has eyes. There are so many, anti-Israel student groups. There is almost no other kind of, student group activity at many of these universities. So it's really the sort of the singular focus on Israel where you start to think, maybe it is anti-Semitic. I want to tell a quick story about John Mearsheimer. John Mearsheimer is in my field. He's a towering figure. He's one of the foundational people within international relations, particularly realism. And he, it's well known, wrote a book about the Israel lobby. And what he likes to say is that ever since he wrote that book, he's been accused of anti-Semitism. And that's because Jews are unable to distinguish between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. And he likes to say he's anti-Zionist, but he's definitely not anti-Semitic. On the other hand, he also likes to say that Israel's response to the second most lethal terrorist attack in world history is exactly like the Holocaust, that there's no difference between Israel responding to the second most lethal terrorist attack in world history and the Holocaust. I highlight that because he's a public figure. He's very influential. Here he is saying that he's anti-Zionist, he's not anti-Semitic, but that Israel's effort to combat, the genocidal terrorist group on its borders that tried to destroy every Jewish person in Israel, that the Israeli response is no different to the Holocaust. And so that's a really good example of how anti-Zionism could look a lot like anti-Semitism, if you pay attention.
Okay, and I'm hoping people are starting to pay attention because what I heard from you as I'm listening and thinking about how this goes is Israel is in some ways a convenient cover-up for basic anti-Semitism as has occurred in the United States over time and in the university systems over time. But you can't say that. You can have anti-Israel groups on your campus, but you can't have an anti-Jewish group. Students against Jewish people, that wouldn't work. And Mearsheimer wouldn't like that either.
And this is why you see so, these influencers on the right sound a lot like the Antifa students on the left. It's
Yes.
because they're united by their anti-Semitism and basically using Israel instrumentally as a cover for their underlying feelings.
So this goes to a conversation that you and I started to have before the program, on combating these things and thinking about how these things go. And it seems to me that the anti-Semitic part, the anti-American Jewish part, the anti any Jewish person part, has a lot to do with not believing that Jews are actually part of our society, especially in America, but alien to it. And they are. Jews are often accused of being Israel firsters. Jews are often accused of not being. But is part of that because we've done a poor job? Part of it is just ugliness. Part of it is just evil people. How do we defend ourselves? It seems to me that part of it is that we, as the American Jewish community, over the last 50 or 60 or 100 years, have done a poor job of explaining who we are in this society. We've allowed them to make this case without standing up for the things that we have done that are extremely American things and that make us Americans. So that's going to get to the question of education at Auschwitz in a moment. You know it is. But is this partly a failing on our
I
part?
mean, some of the irony is when you see these Antifada protesters destroying buildings that are beautiful on campuses that have been donated by Jewish philanthropists to improve their experience in higher education. I think that part of being Jewish, just throughout history, is dealing with societies, regardless of where you are in the world, that don't think that you fully belong. So I have family roots in my lineage that go in the United States that go back something like seven generations. And so we've been part of America for a really long time. And earlier this year, the former head of international affairs at Northeastern accosted me in the hallway in order to get me to apologize for, as well as to criticize, Israeli policy inside of Gaza. And so I said, look, I'm actually, yes, I'm Jewish, but I'm American, very American. And I, I'm not identical to the Israeli, to the IDF. By the way, I fully support what they're doing, and we could have plenty of conversations about that, which would go over the head of international affairs head very quickly. But it's this sense that Jews don't really belong, that somehow we're not American I do think that the implication of your question is true, that if Jews sort of educated their contributions to society, that they wouldn't be seen so negatively by so many people as other, or even a negative aspect of society. But on the other hand, that is going to be a tough fight regardless, because this does seem to be an enduring feature about just for being a Jew. And I've even read, I'm sure you've read similar things, that many Jews in Nazi Germany, they did not think that they were going to be genocided because they were so successful and ingrained in society and respectable and seemingly assimilated in all of the important ways. So I certainly don't have an answer for how Jews can be seen on equal footing as host societies, even ones where they've lived their whole life, which go back, half a dozen generations.
So clearly, there are no real answers to this, but it prompted three more questions because I think anytime you have a Jewish audience, you get more questions than you get answers. The first question, I'll give you all three and see where we go with them. The first is, do you think that some of this, particularly in the college administrations, is an anti-American impulse altogether? And again, Jews are a symbol that these people are really not, well, they are anti-Jewish. But the real gripe is with the United States of America, and this is a mechanism. That's one. Another
That's interesting.
question.
Let me take them in order,
Okay,
if you
let's
don't
see.
mind me.
Let's do that.
I do think that these antifadas are deeply un-American. I mean, people
Un-American
could,
and anti-American. Anti-American.
yeah, definitely un-American, and yes, certainly some manifestations are anti-American. When I've been just fascinated to see people wearing Hamas gear on campuses, or Hezbollah gear, or PFLP gear. These are all U.S. designated foreign terrorist organizations. And even though I've spent 2 decades studying terrorism, I guess I didn't understand that it would be tolerated in the United States to not just be sympathetic to foreign terrorist organizations, but to actually be part of them, to advertise for them, to recruit for them, to chant the exact same slogans, unironically, as these US designated foreign terrorist organizations, and in some cases, literally distribute publications created by groups like Hamas. So how is that not just un-American? That is anti-America for sure.
Which in many cases is against the law, and particularly if you have come in on a visa, that would be construed as material support for terrorism. So yeah, it's important. But as the next participant sent in, governments don't appear very interested in enforcing those laws. And he writes that protests in Winnipeg have people, and I think the laws are reasonably close, Canada near, Palestine from the river to the sea, and kill the Jews in the same demonstration, and there is no consequence. So, have we just abdicated, or we has the government abdicated its responsibility to protect its citizens and to uphold its law? Or what happened in Columbia's library? They wrecked the library while the kids were sitting there. It's not clear yet what's going to happen to those people. Have we given up
Well,
on the enforcement?
I'll answer it this way, because a lot of people have questions around, free speech and Where do you draw the line? Is what is acceptable protest in the United States or Canada? I have a loose rubric on this, which I'll share. And of course, you're welcome to disagree with me, but when people say, let's say on the let's say that we're talking about on the street, in a city or a suburb, but not in a university setting. If somebody were to go out there and say they're in favor of Palestine from the river to the sea, that's perfectly permissible, because in my book, according to me, because essentially they are advocating a foreign policy. Now, even if that advocacy were to include, let's say, even stronger language, where they're advocating for Palestinian terrorists, let's say, to attack, say, in Tel Aviv or inside Jerusalem. Obviously, I don't share those political preferences, but I myself would think that that shouldn't be something that the US government should intervene on. In the same way that if somebody like Pompeo or Nikki Haley were to be like really loose with their language and say something like, we should just like bomb the shit out of Iran or something, and they're not very specific, and it certainly could involve civilian suffering, which is terrible in all cases. I think that that should be permissible as well, because we're dealing with the expression of foreign policy preferences. Where I object is when the advocacy is for local violence, where when people start saying we want a global intifada starting in Hamilton Hall, or we want a global intifada beginning in Ithaca. And the protesters, or whatever you want to call them, very frequently do say that. What in that case, what they are advocating is not just belligerence thousands of miles away. They are advocating for local belligerence. And it is reasonable for people in that area, particularly Jewish people, but honestly, anyone in that vicinity, to be concerned about their public safety, especially when these very groups are highly correlated, proximally, in time, with violence locally. And so I would have liked to have seen the government implement incitement laws much more liberally than they have. This is not a restriction on anybody's political belief. It's a basic matter of public safety. I do think that the rules are different and should be different, at least at universities, where speech is always curtailed. I don't think that you can, that it's exactly the same thing if on some street somebody's saying from the river to the sea. I think that is a little bit different than if you have some crowd screaming it, targeting a Jewish student who's just trying to, study, for example, for finals. But so that's really more of a question about university rules than laws. But anyway, I thought I would take the chance to just explain some of my rubric.
I think that's really important because you are making the distinction between a political opinion, even if it's one we don't care for, and incitement to violence. Whether it should be more strictly enforced on campuses, I think is also very important. But again, I think it's the same fundamental point. If you make someone afraid for their
It should
health
be
and
more
safety,
strictly enforced
yeah,
on
I would
campus.
agree.
It really should, because the mission of the university is for people to get a good education in a, inclusive and nonviolent environment. if you have students like targeting, say, a Chabad house or targeting the library or dorms, you are interfering with the basic mission, the basic pedagogical mission of the university. And anyone who does that should be punished, including expulsion.
You're not going to get an argument from me. So let's go then to the next question that someone has sent in. I think he's more irritated with me than with you. Who asks, why must we Jews explain ourselves? Japanese Americans don't. We didn't start World War II. I think that is on my point that says that we have failed our own selves and our own children and grandchildren, if we have them, in explaining American Jewish history to ourselves. But he says, why do we have to explain ourselves anyway? I would say that self-preservation is the answer to that, but that's just me.
I mean, I think Jews are just treated differently as a minority compared to other groups. And Jews actually are very good at explaining things.
Yes.
Unfortunately, even though, the Glenn Greenwalds of the world like to pretend that the academic freedom bias is in the opposite direction, to a large extent, what the universities have tried to do is to remove the possibility for Jews to explain themselves. The BDS movement is fundamentally anti-academic freedom. It is intended to prevent speakers from Israel to come and explain their country, their research, things about themselves. It's intended to reduce interactions. So it's fundamentally anti-academic freedom. I like to weave, I'm going to weave in another just short little story, and that is that right after Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, the head of Jewish studies at Northeastern, she got together a panel of faculty members to talk about it, and I wasn't invited, even though I should have been the first professor invited there, because I know 1,000 times more than any of the other faculty members there about any of the relevant topics. But I was excluded for people in, anthropology or like all faculty really just came out of the woodworks. As long as they hated Israel, they were seen as being authorities on the topic of terrorism and counterterrorism and Middle East politics. They, had garbage publication records and just totally unknown quantities. But those are the kinds of people who were invited by the head of Jewish studies. And rather than talking sort of, well, dispassionately or even passionately about relevant issues, they started talking about the importance of the BDS movement. But there I was excluded watching this thing on Zoom where the only thing these people had in common was that they were somehow connected to Northeastern and hated Israel. So one of the main goals in order to make the university Zionist free is to prevent a free exchange of ideas. When there is a free exchange of ideas, I really do like our chances. There was this professor named Professor Robert House. He's an endowed NYU law professor who was saying all sorts of obnoxious things on Twitter that I did not think were accurate about. It had to do specifically with the so-called pager operation when Israel blew up a large number of Hezbollah guys with pagers. And he was saying that this is like a huge violation of international law. And I said that it wasn't. And then he was like, no, like I know about international law. So I said, well, why don't you bring your expertise to debate me then? And we could do it in front of my students. I will host you in front of my students and we could debate this issue. I wouldn't normally do this during class time, but you are an endowed professor at NYU Law, which has a good, ranking. And Professor Robert House just absolutely withered. And my students the only real comment they had was, why don't you bring in some stronger competition next time? So I do think that, the free exchange of ideas would be helpful. One of the key strategies of the university system is to prevent it, and they need to because otherwise they'll lose.
So I think we're coming sort of to the close here. And I think what we've done without it ever addressing it is answered the question, is a trip to Auschwitz to understand concentration camps and World War II, is that an appropriate response to what we're seeing on campus today? And I think without saying so and without addressing the question, the answer is it's not going to address the question. So a trip to Auschwitz may teach you a lot of things, and I am not opposed to people learning those things, but it doesn't answer the question for today's college campuses. So let me ask you this, because people who watch us periodically know that I like to go out on an up note, and I think you actually just gave us the up note. What is the answer, Max? Is the answer more conversation? Is the answer more freedom of speech on campuses? How we get there is a different question. But it's the answer to the problem of Jewish concerns on campus and anti-Zionism on campus and anti-Semitism on campus is that more speech, not less speech, not necessarily cutting off the bad guys, but making sure that everybody has a voice.
I think that there has been a lot of focus on what, let's just call them bad apples.
Okay.
These are students who are just completely over the top. They are, the most visible extremists. And I think that in some cases, depending on, their status in America, the Trump administration, is trying to remove them. And I support that. There is also some focus, especially in the Jewish community, on the really sort of bad apple faculty members who really go just too far. They go further, and in some cases, they're more prominent, and they say really noxious things. And people in the Jewish community, especially, they forward around, the quotation. And in some cases, though generally not, the faculty members might get in trouble, but the focus tends to almost always be, whether we're talking about students or faculty, on the very, very bad apples. What I would like to see is more support for the so-called good apples, sort of the rare professor who's still in higher education. Yes, like me, who's Jewish and Zionist and speaks freely, not just about the issues that we've talked about, but across the political spectrum in terms of conservative thought. There isn't many of people like that. There aren't many professors like that for reasons that I explained. And I will say that they are embattled. And so to the extent that we focused not on the bad apples, but help to protect and promote the good apples, that will have a very positive impact in higher education and throughout society.
That's a great and optimistic answer. So let me follow it up with one quickie. How do we help them on your own campus? You see them, you meet them, you are them. How do we help them and how do we change the focus?
There is almost no support for Zionist faculty within higher education. They are really on their own. When philanthropists give money and they're really interested in this issue, they tend to give it to think tanks. They give it to a lot of other places. They might even give it to like Federation, and it could go to, my alma mater, like Salman Schechter, or to various camps that some of us have attended. But for whatever reason, the philanthropists are not promoting the kinds of people and views that they understand are so critical within higher education. One of the lessons over the past couple of years that we've seen is that if you are in a position to like open up your wallets and to give money, don't just give it to universities with no strings attached. It needs to be disaggregated. Otherwise, you're going to be funding more anti-Semitic DEI programs. You might have a building named after you, but there will never ever be a Zionist speaker whoever walks into that building. So I know that this is self-serving, but I do genuinely believe that more targeted investments within higher education are really, really important because the pressure for Zionist professors to leave higher education or to stay quiet has resulted in a situation where coming out of higher education, almost all of it is saying the same thing, that Israel is a genocidal country and that the Israeli response is to Operation Al-Aqsa Flood is like the Holocaust. We need other voices. We need more engagement. We need more shows like the one that you're hosting. And let's try to pump up the audience.
I take that. I take that as a very good answer. Practical ideas for working in the within the college structure. Otherwise, we're going to end up saying our kids shouldn't go to college. I mean, otherwise, there's no hope for it. So I'll take that as a positive answer. Spend your money wisely. Support the students and the faculty who need support. I think the audience realizes, Max, that you were not raising money on my program, but support for faculty and students and administrators, because there must be a few, who are willing to stand for the things they believe in, even if those things are Israel and Zionism and the Jewish people. So we've come to the end. I thank you, Max, for a really interesting kind of roll through what's going on. We see a lot about it, but I think we understand it better now. And that I credit to you, and I thank you for that. To the audience, thank you for joining us. We'll be back again, probably to take a look at President Trump's visit through the Middle East and the Houthis. So we will see you again next time. Thank you very
Thanks,
much for
everybody,
joining
for
us.
tuning in, and thanks to you, Shoshana, for hosting this. Really
My pleasure.
appreciate it.
My pleasure, Max.